Welcome to the Novel Romantics Literature of Chicago podcast series at the Amerikazentrum Hamburg. I'm the host of Novel Romantics, Douglas Cowie. I'm a writer and teacher. And in each episode of this 10-episode series, my guests and I will discuss a work of fiction set primarily in Chicago. For this first episode, we'll be discussing Theodore Dreiser's 1900 novel, Sister Carrie. And my guest today is Katie McGettigan. Katie McGettigan is senior lecturer in American literature at Royal Holloway University of London, where she teaches U.S. writing and film from the Puritans to the present, covering all of it. Her first book, Herman Melville, Modernity and the Material Text, was published in 2017, and she has published essays in American Literature, Journal of American Studies, and Journal of Victorian Culture. Her current research focuses on print cultures of the Atlantic world in the long 19th century, and her second book, The Transatlantic Materials of American Literature, which explores the publication of U.S. writing in Britain and the role played by British publishers and print in the formation of an American literary field, is forthcoming with the University of Massachusetts Press in spring 2023. Welcome, Katie. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Today we're going to discuss Sister Carrie by Theodore Dreiser. It was originally published in 1900, but it's set in Chicago in 1889. So it was published at a time when Chicago had... The Chicago that it was set in and the Chicago that it was published in are basically... They're not two different cities, but they're very different cities.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the idea of Chicago, particularly in the national consciousness, transforms greatly between the late 1880s and the turn of the 20th century. So I guess Chicago by the end of the 1880s is really in America considered a kind of, I guess, an up-and-coming place in some respects, but also in other ways a slightly dangerous place. The 1886 sees an event called the Haymarket Affair, which is a really big event in American labor history, where a protest on behalf of the 8-hour working day turns violent. A bomb explodes kind of mysteriously. No one's quite sure who's responsible. There's shootings, police officers die. And then there's this kind of effectively a show trial, a really kind of big miscarriage of justice in which labor activists are convicted and very quickly executed before anything can be done about it. And this really kind of begins a movement of kind of labor activism in Chicago. There's also the Pullman strikes in the early 1890s, another kind of big labor activism cause. So Chicago is on the one hand this kind of radical city where potentially kind of dangerous things happen. But it's also a kind of city on the make, in which people from all over the country, but also from New York, which is interesting because it's where Carrie goes in the second half of the novel, come with kind of bright new ideas for companies, for inventions, for new ways of doing things. And Chicago, because it is this sort of place where it's possible to make yourself. And I think that's one of the things that Sister Carrie is particularly interested in, this possibility of making oneself.
For sure.
It becomes this place that in the popular imagination is, a kind of an exciting city, but one that doesn't kind of have, I guess, the strictures that somewhere like New York does, which on the one hand gives the possibility for rising, but on the other hand potentially makes it a slightly dangerous place.
Yeah, it's also, Chicago is like, you mentioned people coming in, and like there's all the industrialists and the people with the money people, the business guys are coming in from the East to kind of make themselves in Chicago and, you know, founding the big department stores and everything as well. But it grows huge. It goes from being like the fifth biggest city in the U.S. to the second biggest city in about a decade and a half or something like that. It's like over the 1880s to about 1900. Also, the World's Fair happens in 1893. So it doesn't touch this novel, the World's Fair, even though it's like the event of late 20th century or late 19th century Chicago, right?
Yeah, it's this kind of weird background intertext that's never really directly mentioned, although it was a kind of the, you know, celebrity event of Chicago in the 1890s. So for anyone who doesn't know, the World's Fair is essentially like a huge trade fair, huge exposition that takes place in Chicago in 1893, for which they build essentially an entirely new city on the shores of the lake to celebrate this, called the White City. And it's this massive event, and there's a lot of anxiety in Chicago in the run-up to about whether they'll pull it off. They have the world's first Ferris wheel invented. They try and get something that's like the Eiffel Tower. They want something as kind of good as the Eiffel Tower, which was built for the Paris Exposition. So they build the Ferris wheel. And it is a huge success, and people flock to Chicago to come to see this amazing exposition. Electric lighting is kind of fully on display for the first time. It's one of the things that really popularizes electric lighting. The White City is this kind of gleaming metropolis that becomes one of the inspirations for L. Frank Baum's Emerald City in The Wizard of Oz, another kind of turn of the century Chicago novel, I guess, in a kind of a strange kind of way. But yeah, it doesn't really enter Sister Carrie kind of fully. Like, she doesn't go there, she doesn't visit it. But a lot of kind of critics of the novel have seen it kind of creeping in the background. So some of the descriptions of when Carrie is being courted by her second lover in the text, Hurstwood, and he takes her on these drives through kind of Chicago's wealthy North communities, the descriptions of kind of beautiful buildings and manicured lawns are seen to be kind of reminiscent of the World's Fair that Dreiser did go to and did report on as part of his career as a journalist. And also, I think the kind of movement in Sister Carrie, the rise and the fall, the idea that the characters, so Carrie, over the course of the novel, moves upwards. She starts as a kind of impoverished, very much lower middle class girl who doesn't have a job, who struggles to find work. And by the end of it, she's this successful actress earning, you know, hundreds of dollars per week, living in this beautiful hotel at no cost to herself. And Hurstwood, who starts as a successful manager of a resort, ends up living on the streets, homeless, at the mercy of charities. This kind of pattern of rise and fall has been read as kind of evocative of the Ferris wheel. So what goes up must come down. But also this idea that although people do rise up and down, ultimately, perhaps kind of morally, they stay in one place. So you're,
yeah, they don't go anywhere.
They don't go anywhere. So one of the interesting things about this novel is how far people's circumstances change, but perhaps the question of whether their character, what's within them, changes at all, or whether they just stay the same.
Yeah. Another way of thinking about it is like it's a novel of vice rewarded. Like, it doesn't matter how bad Carrie behaves towards anyone, she just keeps getting rewarded and rewarded and rewarded for it, and has no reason to learn any lessons. She's like the opposite of Pamela in Richardson's novel, like virtue is rewarded.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because in some ways, Carrie is a kind of classic kind of female Bildungsroman figure. So mm-hmm. the novel of progress, the novel of coming of age. So we could see her as a kind of early 20th, turn of the century version of Jane Eyre. Like, she arrives, flings herself on the mercy of relatives, doesn't have any money, is expected to work and earn her keep. But unlike someone like Jane Eyre, who has this kind of consistently strong moral centre that guides her and leads her to make good choices, and she is eventually rewarded with the marriage and the kind of wealth and all of that, Carrie, in some ways, I guess, morally does not make good choices. She chooses to be kind of take up with men who have her as a kept woman. And I'm saying morally not good by the morals of Carrie's own era. Like, I'm not judging her from my own perspective.
But stop judging Sister Carrie.
I know. But I guess the question is really, like, morally, yeah, Carrie makes some questionable choices according to the morals of her own time. But as you say, she's rewarded for them. And I think there is this question of, well, you know, what was she supposed to do?
Yeah.
She begins, as I said, with not much money. She arrives to Chicago, having met this kind of glamorous, or seeming to her glamorous, man, Drouet, on the train. He has nice clothes. That's always good in Carrie's book. He has nice clothes.
I love the opening of the openings. I just opened to the first page. So I want to read a couple of things from it in a minute. But I love that opening scene of the novel, because Drouet is such a charmer, and he's such a sleazeball, and she's just sort of sitting there on the train down from Wisconsin going, oh, okay.
Well, it's so obvious to anyone who has any kind of worldliness at all, who is not as naive as Carrie, that he's a complete chancer. Like, his clothes are like too nice for his occupation. They're kind of showy in like a way that actual rich people don't dress.
Yeah.
And anyone who had a kind of modicum of knowledge about the ways of the world would see right through him. So you get this irony between kind of what what the reader knows instantly, but what Carrie doesn't know at all, which I think is such a great opening.
It also strikes me as a very modern, I mean, like, it feels very contemporary still now reading that scene. Like, you see this kind of thing happening all the time, maybe not on trains into, well, probably also on trains into Chicago. You know, you see it in nightclubs or in bars or in, you know, walking around anywhere. And it's a scene that is very contemporary, it's very modern. I don't know if I feel like there should be a better word I could use for that. But anyway, the novel literally begins with her walking onto the train. And she's been growing up in Wisconsin, and she's heading into Chicago to try and make some money for the family. It describes her this way. It says, it was August 1889. She was 18 years of age, bright, timid, and full of the illusions of ignorance and youth. Whatever touch of regret at parting characterized her thoughts, it was certainly not for advantages now being given up. And then a couple paragraphs later, at the bottom of the first page, it has the first of Dreiser's, like, long passages where he proclaims about the world, some of which in this novel are successful and others of which are more dubious, I suppose. But he says, when a girl leaves her home at 18, she does one of two things. Either she falls into saving hands and becomes better, or she rapidly assumes the cosmopolitan standard of virtue and becomes worse. Of an intermediate balance, under the circumstances, there is no possibility. The city has its cunning wiles no less than the infinitely smaller and more human tempter. There are large forces which allure all the soulfulness of expression possible in the most cultured human. The gleam of a thousand lights is often as effective as the persuasive light in a wooing and fascinating eye. And it goes on and on and on in there. He moves from this girl to, like, then the city is a force, but it's also a kind of personified force. Like, he calls it superhuman in the middle of the paragraph. I mean, he already is running away with himself. But it's interesting that, just to come back to your Ferris wheel thing, it's like she's either going to become better or become worse, mm-hmm. or possibly both. It can't be intermediate because she's going around on a wheel, I suppose, and that the city is this force that's going to make it happen.
Yeah, and I think this idea of external forces acting on people in ways that they cannot resist or control is something that Dreiser is kind of interested in. And Sister Carrie, really across all of his novels, there are these moments where there's a determinism. And the train itself is a really interesting symbol of this determinism, right? You're on it and you can't get off. Like, you've just got to wait.
Yeah, you can only go where it's going.
Yeah, takes you where it's going to go. And so that sense that the city is also this kind of deterministic force that will take you where you're going to go. It will lift you up or put you down, and really you don't particularly have much control over which it's going to do. And yeah, I'm really interested in this idea of kind of the relationship between Chicago as a city and the figures in the text, because at this moment it seems like Chicago is maybe Dure, right? He's that kind of attractive, seductive force. But at other times, Chicago is kind of Carrie, like this figure who is in the process of becoming, and is always kind of in this process of becoming, is always kind of, doesn't ever quite reach a kind of fully formed state, which I think is interesting.
No, yeah, there's a lot to unpack about how that works in the novel, because it's not only in Chicago. Half this novel is set in Chicago, half of it in New York, and he makes the point at the beginning of the New York part where he says something to the effect of, like, however bad things could get in Chicago, in New York they can get so much worse, and then like, you know, they do. And even at the end, like, there's one character who we'll maybe talk about later called Ames, who is a guy from Indiana, and I suppose in that sense it kind of, Dreiser himself being from Indiana, it's like he kind of almost a stand-in for the author's point of view maybe, and he's sort of giving some advice to Katie, and Katie, I'm sorry, I was looking at you and I misspoke. He's giving some advice to Carrie and trying to, like, morally center her or ethically center her, and she's just, it's almost like she's got a monkey banging a pot in her head when he's saying it. She's just kind of going, oh, why would he say that to me? I don't know. And then she kind of moves on from it. But I wonder if we should set up a little bit of how these dynamics of the city work through the people so that we can maybe unpack them a little bit more as we go. Like, so Carrie arrives in the city, this traveling salesman, Drouet, likes the look of her and chats her up on the train. She then goes to her sister and brother-in-law's little apartment, and they're not very sympathetic people. I feel bad for them, the Olsons.
Interesting thing, right, is that in some ways, they're the people who are doing everything right. Like, he has a job, he works hard, they save money, they've bought their little lot they're going to build a house on, they live within their means, but they're just, oh God, they're awful. Like,
they're really portrayed as, like, miserable Norwegians.
Miserable Scandinavians, sorry about that, you know, stereotype coming in here. But yeah, like the kind of worst aspects of the Protestant work ethic, really, like parsimonious, just overly moralizing. Like, Carrie wants to, as you know, you can understand this, Carrie wants to have fun, she wants to see the theater, she wants to see the city, and they're like, oh no, you don't want to do that, like, it's just cost money,
give us your money,
don't have any fun. And there, you know, she has to get a job, and she finds actually this is harder than she thought it would be. And I think this is one of the interesting points, I think, where Dreiser kind of sits on the fence about Carrie morally. Because on the one hand, I think as a reader, you are sympathetic to her struggle to get work. Like, she is, she is trying. She's also not trying that hard at times.
Yeah.
And when she does get a job, and it's not a particularly nice job, she gets a job in a shoe factory. But on the other hand, she also doesn't, you know, she could work harder and she could do more. And she's very judgmental about the people she works with. And yeah, she doesn't, you know, and she loses that job quite quickly because she gets ill and she can't go back to it. And so some of this is beyond Carrie's control and we do feel sympathetic for her. But on the other hand, we're starting to see that maybe she is also someone who, when it's offered, will very quickly take the easy way out. So when she comes into Chicago, she comes into Chicago with Drew, and he kind of gives her his address and says, look me up when you're in the city. And she does, and they do get together. And then he gives her some money and says, you know, buy yourself some nice clothes, which will prove to be the thing that convinces Carrie of anything, whether she can buy some nice clothes. So he says, you know, get yourself some shoes and a jacket. It's too cold. You need to have some better things. And she takes the money, and she sort of knows that she shouldn't, because she's got herself into this kind of unspoken contract with this man, and he is going to want something back. And even in her naivety, she knows what that is. On the other hand, she's living a pretty miserable existence, and like, could it really be worse? And so she this is the kind of first step, either upwards or downwards, depending on whether you're looking at her kind of financial success or her moral trajectory. And then she moves in, or Drew moves her into a furnished room, which is much nicer, and she begins kind of an existence as a kept woman.
Yeah, and it's also that thing of, she comes to the city because she needs money, but then discovers that she needs money to be in the city, and then money ends up becoming the city in that sense. And it's not that just for Carrie that's true, right? Because then Drew introduces her to Hurstwood, who is a bit more, he is kind of more the real deal that Drue appears to be, like, presents himself as, right?
Yeah. Hurstwood actually has real money and a nice house in the north of the city. He manages a resort, which by which I guess is meant kind of pleasure gardens, bars, restaurants, you know, places where rich people go to spend money. And he has a wife and two children who he doesn't really like. But also, again, this is one of the things where you're like,
the portrait of his family life is, like, hysterically miserable.
It is.
It's so comedic.
And again, I think both sides are to blame. Like, his wife and children are awful and money-grabbing and don't really care about him as a person as much as him as a material provider. But on the other hand, he doesn't really make any efforts to actually get to know his wife. He's deceptive. So Drue introduces Hurstwood and Carrie. Hurstwood immediately likes the look of her. And having already started a bit of kind of philandering on the side, decides that he's going to try and do the same with Carrie. And so, you know, takes to visiting Carrie when Drue, as a traveling salesman, is out of the city, takes her on these carriage rides, and doesn't tell her he's married, which is the big thing. Like, does not ever say that he's married. So Carrie, having been like, well, one guy did this for me, this other guy seems to be doing it for me, why not? Like, I also like him. He's more sophisticated than Drew. I can tell that. He's got more money. Maybe he'll give me a few more opportunities. And he does give Carrie this.
And he does, So I was just thinking, he does.
The big opportunity that becomes the kind of...
gets her onto the stage.
But So
for one of my favorite chapters in the novel,
the one where she's actually in the play.
Yeah, Hour in Elfland. That I should point out at this stage that the titles to the chapters in this novel cannot be beaten.
They're all really good.
Hysterically over the top.
Yeah.
And then chapter 19 is called An Hour in Elfland, A Clamor Half Heard. And it's wonderful. It's like a fundraiser, isn't it?
Yeah, so they're doing a performance of Under the Gaslight, which was a really popular melodrama written in the mid-19th century, but performed like consistently well into the 20th. And actually, if anyone knows, that's the kind of famous recurring scene where somebody is tied to the railway and they get rescued. Under the Gaslight is the play that scene originates in. So that's the play they're performing. Excellent. As a melodrama. Yeah.
And Hurstwood has engineered a role for her in this play so that he can... I think there's so much interesting about this, because he's engineered this role basically so he can go to the theater and admire her on the stage and sort of, you know, ogle her from... In polite company or something.
Yeah, and I guess you're right, a respectability to something that he's already doing. And kind of showing her off, right? Like, look how clever I am that I found this beautiful girl and I can get some kind of admiration through her. But, like, it's interesting because obviously at first she's not very good.
So the other thing that's important here is that Hurstwood and Drouet are sitting next to each other at the play.
Yeah.
It's a great love triangle scene, as well as being this ridiculous play in a play scene, or, you know, story within a story scene. And, like, there's so much happening here. But yeah, she's terrible.
Yeah.
At first.
And then Drouet goes back to talk to her and sort of say, like, you know, I need, you know, you've just got to do it. Like, you did it in rehearsal. Go on out and do it. And actually, you know, she does. And it seems, and it's really interesting the way that Dreiser describes it, because it's almost as though there's this kind of paradox in which Carrie is a natural actress. So she is most herself when she is pretending to be someone else. And this act of pretending to be someone else is the thing that she is kind of intrinsically good at. So it's a sort of very complicated thing to try and work out, like this relationship between acting and being, and the line that gets drawn between acting and being. And I think with Carrie particularly, it's very, very difficult, even when you finish the novel, to work out what she actually is versus what she just chooses to perform. And this is really why she's such a good actress, I think.
Yeah, there's the moment, this is on page 168 in my edition, where she's on stage. This is the moment where suddenly she starts becoming a good actor. She's acting alongside a professional. It says, "It means," the professional actor said, began speaking as Ray, "that society is a terrible avenger of insult. Have you ever heard of the Siberian wolves? When one of the pack falls through weakness, the others devour him. It is not an elegant comparison, but there is something wolfish in society. Laura has mocked it with a pretense, and society, which is made up of pretense, will bitterly resent the mockery." At the sound of her stage name, Carrie started. She began to feel the bitterness of the situation. The feelings of the outcast descended upon her. She hung at the wing's edge, wrapped in her own mounting thoughts. She hardly heard anything more save her own rumbling blood. And then she basically misses her cue for a second, because this moment on the stage has made her think about her own situation, like, the most deeply she probably thinks about it at all in the entire novel, actually, at this moment.
Yeah.
Before or after. And then she goes out and acts her brains out and steals the show. And what I always find really interesting as an extra element of this is that then you have Drouet and Hurstwood sitting there, and it very explicitly it talks about how much they are admiring. Oh, Carrie's brilliant. And they're admiring this illusion that she's putting on, which they've also previously admired their projection, their own illusion that they've projected onto her. And so these illusions of the city being sort of centered on Carrie, I just think are great in this scene.
Yeah, and this idea that ultimately what they're admiring is also is their own efforts, right? They both feel like they made Carrie, like she's something that they manufactured. And yeah, I think you're right, this does come back to the city, which is always described as being kind of these glass-fronted buildings where Carrie's kind of constantly catching her own reflection as she kind of mm-hmm. walks between the department stores. So the idea that what the city is really good for is reflecting back on you what you want to see from it, rather than mm-hmm. than revealing anything deeper about yourself, I think is really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. This is where Hurstwood really decides to go for broke.
Yeah, so he's decided now that Carrie is it. Carrie is what he wants. At this point, it sort of also becomes revealed to Drouet via a neighbour that Hurstwood has been visiting when he's away. And he kind of confronts Carrie about this. And Carrie says, well, what of it? You know, you did the same thing with me. And he says, well, don't you know mm-hmm. he's married? And Carrie has this kind of breakdown because this is for her a sort of step too far.
Yeah.
At this point, so she refuses to see Hurstwood. Hurstwood's wife gets a kind of inkling that things have been going wrong, and then gets a bit more of an inkling when someone says to her, oh, I saw your husband at that fantastic theatre performance, and he said you were sick and you couldn't come. And she's like, what is he doing? What is he doing? And basically says to him, like, you know, you're going to give me what I want, or I'm going to divorce you, and that will ruin you, because he has to keep up a respectability for his occupation. So she says, just, you know, if you keep me money, then I'll be all right. We'll keep this on, but don't expect any kind of kindness from me.
Yeah.
And Hurstwood's like feeling a bit under pressure now, because he's got money, but not quite as much money as the people his wife runs with. So, and he's mm-hmm. also got to now keep Carrie as well, because she's accustomed to a certain standard, and he feels very trapped. And he doesn't know what he's going to do. And Carrie's also not speaking to him because it's been revealed he's married. And he finds himself in his office late one night, and this is the real kind of pivot point of the text.
Yeah. And a great, great scene, it has to be said.
So good. So he's in the habit of kind of going out after work, coming back to check everything is kind of locked up before he goes home. And it happens on this one night where he's in the middle of this kind of crisis that actually, and this is kind of Dreiser's determinism, kind of chance and fate, it has not been locked up. The safe hasn't been locked, and the takings for the day, which is a kind of £100,000 or more, are not locked away. And you get the scene that every time I read it, it's one of those scenes that you go back to and you wonder whether it's going to end differently, even though I know it's not going to.
Yeah.
I know exactly how it's going to turn out. And I'm still there shouting, like, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't take the money. And he's just like,
this is also,
I'll just hold it for a bit.
Yeah, I'm just going to hold this money. This is in a chapter 27 called When Waters Engulf Us, We Reach for a Star.
Such a good chapter.
And he's like, yeah, he's like, so he comes in and he sees the money in the safe. He's like, oh, that's weird. The safe isn't locked. Well, I better just lock the safe. And just as he's going to, he's like, I'll just hold the money. And then everything's happening like outside of his control somehow, at least in his mind of it. And it's one of these things where the author is really taking advantage of focalizing the telling of a story through a character's, just a light touch on the character's perception, right? So he's got this ironic distance to Hurstwood, but he's also making use of Hurstwood's point of view. And it's like, I'm just going to hold the money. And then, somehow there's all this like passive voice, like things just keep happening to Hurstwood. The money happens to be in his hand. The safe door happens to click locked while he's holding it. And it's like, what, did a breeze, like a really strong breeze, rip through the Fitzgerald and Moy office and close the safe? Or did Hurstwood actually close it, you know?
Yeah, and it's this, again, this moment where you don't know. So it's this, you know, while the money was in his hand, the lock clicked. It had sprung. Did he do it? And you're like, well, did he? And maybe he must have done, but because the focalization is from his perspective, he's not going to give that away. And it suits Hurstwood to treat this as a kind of, a fatalistic thing that he couldn't possibly have avoided. And then once the money's in his hand, well, he can't just call them up and say, oh, I've got this money, because they'd know he was stealing. Yeah. And it's like, well, you've put a spin on that there, Hurstwood. Like, you could have explained anything. And probably people like to trust other people. They would have you know, nodded it away. But no, he takes this as a sign that what he's got to do is take the money and leave Chicago with Carrie. And so he lies to Carrie again and says that Drouet has been hurt and she needs to come to the hospital. And the quickest way they can do this is to get on a train. But unbeknownst to Carrie, he's bought a ticket to Montreal, so over the border, and she gets on the train. And then she's like, tell me a bit more about what's happened to Drouet. And Hurstwood says, oh, you know, it's fine. And then Carrie eventually gets out of him that nothing has happened to Drouet, but they're running away together.
Yeah, and then she says, I want to get out of the train. And this is, comes back to what you were saying. So she comes into Chicago on a train, and you know, that's where she wants to end up. And now she's leaving Chicago on a train, not to where she wants to be.
Yeah.
And, but she's got no choice.
She can't get off.
The train doesn't stop.
Yeah, they can't get off the train. Yeah. And in the same way that Hurstwood has framed this as, well, I don't have a choice. I've got the money now. Events are set in motion. And but then he's like, he doesn't really follow through on his new career as a robber, because news soon reaches him that obviously his former bosses are like, you've stolen the money, haven't you? Like, this is quite obvious. You've stolen the money. If you send it back, you know, obviously you're not going to have your job, but we won't prosecute you. But Hurstwood realizes that he's going to need something to start a new life, because unlike Carrie, he's kind of got a sense that he's going to need money to be in a new city. So he keeps some of it. They buy a load of new clothes. Obviously, that's, again, back to the clothes.
Hey, yeah.
They go shopping. They buy a load of new clothes in Montreal. He keeps, I think, $1,500 of it, sends
something
the rest
like
back.
That, yeah.
And then they hop on a train for their next adventure, another train, this time into New York.
Yeah. And that's, I've got the chapter open, chapter 30, The Kingdom of Greatness, the pilgrim a Dream. It opens like this: whatever a man like Hurstwood could be in Chicago, it is very evident that he would be but an inconspicuous drop in an ocean like New York. In Chicago, whose population still ranged about 500,000, millionaires were not numerous. The rich had not become so conspicuously rich as to drown all moderate incomes in obscurity. The attention of the inhabitants was not so distracted by local celebrities in the dramatic, artistic, social, and religious fields as to shut the well-positioned man from view. In Chicago, the two roads to distinction were politics and trade. In New York, the roads were any one of a half hundred, and each had been diligently pursued by hundreds, so that the celebrities were numerous. The sea was already full of whales. A common fish must needs disappear wholly from view, remain unseen. In other words, Hurstwood was nothing.
Poor Hurstwood. Yeah, and I think this is another moment where essentially, so what essentially happens when they move to New York is that their positions over a course of time reverse. So Hurstwood buys into a bar, but it never really makes him much money, and then it collapses. So he loses his investment and he loses his job. And he does the same thing that Carrie does when she arrives in Chicago. It's a kind of mirror scene where he traipses the streets looking for work, finds that he doesn't have enough money to buy into a position that would really pay, but also he's kind of too well qualified and too old, quite frankly,
too old
for a kind of an entry level position, as we might call it now. And so he can't find a job. And like, exactly like Carrie, really, on the one hand, we're a bit sympathetic to this. Like, Hurstwood's made some bad choices, but he is also in a difficult position here. But then again, he also doesn't try very hard. And he's got a certain
sense... he gives up pretty quick.
He does give up pretty quick. He's got a certain sense of what life owes him, and he's not willing to try other things. And he finds it easier to just kind of put off the problem of not having a job.
He's like his own family in that respect, right? Like, that's the problem of his kids, as far as he's concerned, is that it is exactly that. They're comfortable with what they have. They have certain expectations, and they don't really want to lift a finger to change anything or to make anything themselves. And you see him kind of in a similar predicament.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And also this idea that once you have risen, you don't want to do it again. Like, it's kind of Dreiser's, I think, critique of this kind of American mythology of kind of self-makingness, this idea that you can build yourself up, but also that once people reach a particular position, they don't want to do that anymore. They want things to be given to them. Like, the kind of hard work gets its own rewards isn't a philosophy that they kind of appreciate anymore, I guess. So Hurstwood does kind of have this I guess, like, real midlife crisis, where he just, like, stops getting dressed in the mornings, just sits around the apartment all day in his kind of dressing gown.
He's a real portrait of depression, really.
Yeah.
It doesn't really exist as a term at this time or whatever, but it is a portrait of a, not just a midlife crisis, but of a middle-aged man getting depressed.
Yeah, there's this really kind of excruciating scene where Carrie's friends turn up and he's in his dressing gown and he hasn't got dressed, and you're just like, oh God, this is painful. And it's moments like that where you do feel sorry for him,
mm-hmm.
and feel that he has, and I think you begin to feel more sorry for him, even though he continues to maybe not make some great choices. But at the same time that he's falling, Carrie is like, right, I've got to do something about this because we don't have any money. And he's not going to, she quickly does, and this is one of the moments where she is a kind of gets more clarity, I think, on things, and sees Hurstwood for what he is, in not a particularly kind way, but perhaps quite a kind of perceptive way, and realizes that if anyone's going to get them out of this mess, it's going to be her. And she's like, well, I always wanted to be an actress and I was pretty good at it, so I'm going to go around and try and get myself a position. And because she's pretty, she does, she succeeds, she finds a small company that will take her as a chorus girl. And it is, you know, she is a good actress. She's good on the stage and she impresses people and she does her parts well. And so her kind of, I guess, second kind of rise begins, her New York rise. And in some ways, this rise is more easy for a reader to kind of buy into and feel sympathetic. But she's not rising on the basis of what men give to her. She's rising on the basis of her own talents.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I was just looking at an interesting passage at the end of chapter 35. It says where she's feeling sorry, like Hurstwood's self-respect has vanished, and so her respect for him has as well. And then she says, he had some money, he had a decent suit remaining, he was not bad looking when dressed up. She did not forget her own difficult struggle in Chicago, but she did not forget either that she had never ceased trying. He never tried. He did not even consult the ads in the papers anymore. I think she did not forget she'd never ceased trying. And I think, is that really true, Carrie?
No.
Did you really never cease? You never really, you kind of did cease trying.
Yeah, she's
pretty quickly.
She's on the verge of going back to Columbia City, isn't she, at the moment when Juliet comes and says, oh, I'll give you an apartment. And so she, yeah, I think this idea of Carrie's ability here to rewrite her own history as one of self-making, when she hasn't been self-made at all until this point.
Yeah, but then she does, as you say, she does actually make herself. She gets herself into a chorus line, and then she seizes the opportunities to become, you know, what she wants.
Yeah, she does things to get herself noticed. She takes the parts they're given her. She negotiates for her pay. But all this really does is make her, I guess, very resentful of Hurstwood's dependence on her. And this is the point, right, that Hurstwood has a brief foray into strike breaking.
Yeah.
Which I guess we should probably talk about as well.
Which doesn't go well.
No, it does not. So there is a kind of trolley driver's strike in New York. And Hurstwood sees that they are looking for men to drive the trolleys, essentially to scab. So this is a real period of kind of industrial unrest in the United States, and a very strong kind of left wing energy that is often forgotten, I think, in histories of the United States. So this is a moment where there's real public investment in socialism as a possibility, in which kind of union leaders are becoming national heroes. And Dreyse is very interested, as you know, as a journalist, he was reporting on this, and he's very interested in this. So he talks about the kind of trolley workers' strike and this idea that they're looking for people. And for Hurstwood, this is a chance to finally earn some money. But he sort of very much underestimates how difficult this is going to be. And again, I think this is a moment where we're very conflicted in our feelings towards him and our sympathies, that on the one hand, you know, it's not a great thing to do to assist in strike breaking by offering one's labour. On the other hand, he doesn't have that many options, and he is subjected to kind of really quite scary violence, I think, at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting how it's interesting the effect, like, Dreiser's fairly good on pinpointing the changes in Hurstwood's attitude through this moment, right? So I'm just looking at the chapter now, like at the beginning, he's when he's jumping into the job, he says Hurstwood, he's talking to a couple other guys and says Hurstwood paid some little attention to this. Somehow he felt a little superior to these two, a little better off. To him, these were ignorant and commonplace poor sheep in a driver's hand. And it's like, you know, he's still that sneery, snotty, snobbish guy that he was when he was managing Fitzgerald and Moyes back in Chicago, with no real conception that he's actually worse than them.
Yeah, quite. And that he's there too, right? And actually, he doesn't understand how any of the kind of labor systems work, like what you're supposed to do to kind of get your lunch or to sign up for stuff. And yeah, and he, yeah, you're right. He's definitely got the sense of his own superiority.
Yeah, and now that he's on the tram, Hurstwood, warm and excited, gazed steadily ahead. It was an astonishing experience for him. He had read of these things, but the reality seemed something altogether new. He was no coward in spirit. The fact that he had suffered this much now rather operated to arouse a stolid determination to stick it out. He did not recur in thought to New York or the flat. This one trip seemed a consuming thing. He's no longer snobbish and apart from it. He's completely consumed by it out of necessity, really.
Yeah. And I think I really like that phrase, this idea of the kind of consuming thing, because this is a text that's about kind of consumption running both ways, right? This idea of a kind of insatiable desire to consume things and consume people that is really the defining aspect of all the characters in the text. But also this sense that if one is not a consumer, like if one doesn't have the resources to be a consumer, then you are consumed and you will be consumed by the city. And there isn't, it's again that going back to that very first passage that you discussed, this idea that there's no in-between point. You either are consuming or you're consumed.
Yeah. And so we should finish off what happens in this scene. He gets basically knocked out, not beaten up exactly, but he gets yanked out of the tram and knocked down, and then he goes home and reads about it in the paper.
Which in some ways, like, I think I'm just looking at that very end sentence where he adjusted his paper very comfortably and continued. It was the one thing he read with absorbing interest. That there is almost this kind of like, oh, I'm in the papers, isn't that?
I was like, yeah, my margin note there says, what, so it's just entertainment again? Yeah. It's hard to figure out what that means, I think.
Yeah, or whether, like, I guess I keep thinking that he enjoys reading the papers earlier, doesn't he? Because he likes seeing the celebrities there that used to come into his resort. And it's almost, and he sort of feels there's a sadness that he's not a part of that world. And almost like being in the papers, he is again, but also, like, just completely not. Like, it's a completely different kind of being in the papers. But that what he wants, and I think this is just something that's in Hurstwood, that what he wants above all is recognition. And he feels that he's owed recognition, that he's the kind of man that should be recognized and people should recognize him. Although then he hates being recognized in New York, because obviously he's been recognized for the wrong thing. So that sense of a spotlight, I think, which is also what he gives to Carrie, which is interesting.
Yeah.
He somehow got it again, but obviously not in a
really
way he was
twisted
intended.
Kind of way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that kind of brings us to the Hurstwood's end.
Yeah.
There's the real contrast, if we think about them on the Ferris wheel again. Like they've gotten off it. Somehow they got on the Ferris wheel roughly together, maybe a couple cars apart.
Yeah.
But now they're 180 degrees away from each other.
And so this is the point where Carrie kind of decides she can't take it anymore. And I was just going to read her letter to him, because it is
probably
one of my favorite parts of the entire text. So she's decided she's sick of giving him money, and a friend of hers from the Chorus Line says, come and move in with me. And she kind of jumps at this chance to just leave him behind. He's just kind of holding her back now. And so, you know, to give Carrie her due, she does borrow some money from a friend, so she's not leaving him absolutely destitute. And then she writes this letter that she leaves the money and he reads. Dear George, he read, crunching the money in one hand. I'm going away. I'm not coming back anymore. It's no use trying to keep up the flat. I can't do it. I wouldn't mind helping you if I could, but I can't support us both and pay the rent. I need what little I make to pay for my clothes. I'm leaving $20. It's all I have just now. You can do whatever you like with the furniture. I won't want it. Carrie. Oh, and it's just like, it's the emphasis on material things, right? So this idea that she's leaving him because she can't, not because she doesn't love him, which is actually true. Like, he's not the man she thought he was, but because she can't financially support him. Then this just like classic Carrie line, like, I need what little I make to pay for clothes. Like, this idea that that's ultimately what she wants in life is to be well-dressed, to wear the costume, to put on a good impression. And she can't do that and have him. And then she makes her choice of things. Like, she chooses things.
Yeah.
And then this final line about the furniture, like, do what you want with the furniture. There's nothing about the kind of life that they've built together or their relationship, which is because ultimately their relationship was based on what each of them could do for each other.
Yeah, and in the lies that he told, she's very explicit about, there's a scene earlier where he's like, yeah, she says, I'm not married to you. And he's like, well, what did we do in Montreal? And she's like, it was lies.
Yeah.
It was lies. So forget it, buddy.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's the illusion again, right? Yeah. Like, if he falls in love with an illusion of her as a young girl that he can kind of take under his arm or whatever, make him feel younger, and he falls in love with the illusion of her that he puts on the stage in the Am-Dram performance in Chicago, then here's that illusion. Like, everything's built on these illusions, or the reflections in the shop glass that you were talking about earlier.
And the minute you turn the stage lights off and take the costumes off, right, take the clothes off, you're nothing's underneath. And I think there is this real emptiness of character that should, like, you would think was a failing in a text, but Dreiser makes it this kind of calling card of Sister Carrie, that there's just, aside from, and I'm kind of riffing on a really kind of influential reading by Walter Ben Michaels here, but like, aside from the things that people want, they don't have anything. And if all you are is what you want, then you're nothing at all. And that there is this just kind of flatness and emptiness that everyone is just waiting for what they can trade up to, this kind of exchangeability of swapping themselves for another. That's just kind of exposed completely by the end of this text.
Yeah, this is where it leaves him. This is just after he's read the letter. Then something like a bereaved affection and self-pity swept over him. She needn't have gone away, he said. I'd have got something. He sat a long while without rocking and added quite clearly out loud, I tried, didn't I? At midnight, he was still rocking, staring at the floor. I tried, didn't I? Not really.
God.
Not really.
It's just, and this, the rocket, so the rocket, so I talked about the Ferris wheel before, but the rocking chair is another one of these things, recurring symbols in the text, right? There's lots of moments where different people sit in rocking chairs. Yeah. And again, it's this illusion of motion, but you're not actually going anywhere. Yeah. So, and it, like, you're right, it's this deception. Well, I would have got somewhere. I would have risen again. It's like, but you wouldn't, would you? Like,
you wouldn't have,
just stuck in one place, and she knows it.
Yeah, because doesn't Olsen sit in his rocking chair in the evenings when he gets home from work?
He sits in his rocking chair. There's several scenes of, so Carrie sits in that chair, and then at the end, she's also sitting in a rocking chair.
Which is
interesting about this idea that she does it. She does it in the first rooms in Chicago that she goes to, where she's nothing, and she does it again in New York when she's something. She's a big deal. But she's doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh, what a novel.
Yeah, it's really good.
I wonder, just as a way of maybe wrapping up our discussion, we just talk a little bit about, well, there's like a couple things, actually. I was thinking about the style. I've touched on the style of the novel a bit, and just talk a little bit about Dreiser as a journalist, writing a novel, and how you feel about the style of this novel. Because one of the things that's said about this novel sometimes is that it's like the greatest bad book ever written and that kind of thing. And it's quite a strange thing to say about a novel. Like, and I feel quite ambivalent about it myself, because part of me thinks, well, how can it be a bad novel if it's great? And it is great. I love Sister Carrie. But at the same time, there's a lot of awful writing in
there
it
is.
And what does that exactly mean to you, I guess, is kind of what I'm asking.
Yeah, so that's, I think you kind of hit on it earlier where you said there are lots of these paragraphs where Dreiser kind of pauses and is like, let me tell you about Chicago in 1899, or let me tell you about what the department stores were like, or let me tell you about business in New York. And in some ways, they shouldn't work. Like, if you were editing Theodore Dreiser, that would be the bit where you're like, get rid of it. That's your research showing. Like, just cut it out. But I think there's something about, and again, it comes back to this idea that these characters have a kind of flatness to them, that they really, in some ways, there isn't any depth to anybody. Like, they almost seem actually incapable, aside from Ames, perhaps, of any true depth. So in some ways, I think this kind of idea that this is just kind of an account of what people do. And in some ways, it's left to the reader to kind of psychoanalyze why they do it, which in some ways feels a kind of maybe proto-modernist, maybe even proto-postmodernist, that we are kind of given these shifting surfaces and invited to think about what might be going on behind them. But Dreiser's account is quite almost a kind of journalistic detachment, a refusal to, or in some ways an encouragement to come to judgments, but a refusal to kind of pass them entirely. Like, I find it interesting to think about whether Sister Carrie is a moralistic novel. Like, are we supposed to ultimately judge these people as good or bad, or are we just simply presented with a set of circumstances and been told, well, you know, judge all you want, but like, is that fundamentally going to change anything? Like, this is how.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, judge all you want, but it is what it is anyway. It goes back to those opening paragraphs of the novel where he says, look, a girl of 18 rolls into the city, she's either going to get better or worse, and there's nowhere in between. And he's telling you the story he's going to tell you, and he's almost asking you at that point, you judge for yourself whether she gets better or worse. Like, she materially gets better. I'm not sure she does get any morally worse as the novel
goes on. And that's interesting, because I don't think Carrie fundamentally changes. She perhaps gets more aware of the world that she's living in, but she doesn't, and she becomes aware, I guess, of her need for self-reliance. That's a kind of big change, I suppose. But her moral compass about what's good or bad, and I was going to say it doesn't shift, but then I'm like, I'm not sure I even really know what it is. Like, she knows what's expedient or what's going to serve her at any point. And I guess she does react quite strongly to Hurstwood being married, but whether that's because she feels like a relationship with a married man is morally unacceptable, whether she's just annoyed that he's lied to her, is a difficult thing to determine, I think.
Yeah, and he doesn't. It's one of the things that's, I think, very good about this novel. Perhaps, I don't know, maybe even a bit groundbreaking about this novel in American literature, that he allows you to have that ambiguity, and he allows. This is something that we'll see again in other novels that I'm going to discuss with people in this series. That he allows the characters the benefit of their point of view, right or wrong.
Yeah.
And we see that again in James Farrell's work. We see that again in Richard Wright's work. We see it again in Nelson Algren's work in particular. For me, he's the guy who does it, like, to the apotheosis of its thing. But it's Dreiser is the one who's breaking that ground a little bit and saying it's not a morality tale. It might be a tragedy, but it's not a morality tale. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend otherwise.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's worth saying that this, the kind of that point is very controversial about this text when it's first published. So it's accepted by the publisher as Dreiser has it, and then one of the publisher's wives is like, hang on, this is a pretty immoral book. Have you looked closely at this? And they want to edit it, and Dreiser says, no, you've agreed, we have to publish it. So it's published, but they do very, very little to kind of promote it. It's really a failure. And then it's only in an edited text that circulates for a long period of time, I think until the 1980s, when the original text is then republished. So it's certainly that wasn't something that was accepted particularly at its moment of publication.
Yeah. Great. Thank you very much for joining me on the Literature of Chicago podcast. Katie McGettigan has been my guest, and it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Doug.
just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the AmericaCentrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.